Sure, we can call it. I'm in favor of that, Sam.
Can we let the artificial intelligence decide?
Have we adequately disappointed you?
Yes. Yes, you have.
Oh, Lord.
I really look forward to the evaluation of this discourse by an AI in the future and how much it's going to laugh at us.
An AI in the future from Belgium.
Yes. Well, hopefully it will be a merciful AI from the future from Belgium.
Yes. Mike, this is the time to apologize. I'm just throwing it out there.
Preempt the next episode, Mike. Yeah.
I like how
in the dying seconds of the game, Sam just supplied the intro bit. Like the Pats coming back to win the Super Bowl in the last seconds, Sam saves.
Yeah.
Listening to you guys on headphones, and so my audio should be pretty clean.
Well, Simon, you know what's clean? A good beer is very clean.
And Tide detergent. Tide detergent. For if you need to get those stains out, Tide detergent.
Beer stains, perhaps?
Yes, beer stains.
What about beer steins?
I don't know if it gets those out. I think you need the combined might of England, France, and the United States to get those out.
And don't forget, Mike, you always forget, and Belgium.
And Belgium, yes. And
the Russians
Belgium.
May have helped.
The Russians may have helped, yes.
Sam, I've actually failed you because I do not have a beer. I have a lovely glass of water. So.
Oh, that's disappointing. I have stuck with tradition.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to count this as a podcast now.
Yeah, does this count as a podcast? I don't know.
You guys should talk about your beer, even though I'm out in the cold on this one.
Sam, what do you got for us?
I'm really disappointed that I can't share the beer that I have, actually. I have an Otto's Rye Ale, and it's named after Zeno. I don't know whether they intentionally named it after a Greek philosopher or if somebody just thought it was a cool name, but it's a really good rye ale, and unfortunately it's only available, you know, in Pennsylvania, so if you live in Pennsylvania, cool, you can go to Otto's and get some. If not, well, you know, good luck.
See, I thought you said Zemu. I thought you were going somewhere completely different with it.
Premium
Scientology beer.
Right. Yeah. Simon, I actually boycott Scientology beer, so that will not be crossing my palate at any point.
You have to figure it's pretty strong stuff.
Well, they do manage to get all the thetans out in the fermentation process, so...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's actually a way to help you... erase traumatic memories, their beer. You know, it's got a special ingredient.
There you go. Yep. Yep. All clear. Yep.
Okay, so having, you know, mended fences with the Belgians, we're now offending the Scientologists. Good to know. Okay. It's a great strategy. Mike, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a beer called Creme Brulee. It's an imperial milk stout. It's designed to be like a dessert beer milk stout. It's kind of odd. It's brewed with vanilla beans, and so it's got kind of this creme brulee taste to it, but it's got this really, really sharp aftertaste that makes it not completely pleasant. But I've got an entire pint of it, and I intend on finishing it, so...
Sharp as in like a tart aftertaste or like a hoppy aftertaste?
Like a tart aftertaste. Ooh. It's not completely hoppy. It's like the odd combination of the sweetness of the vanilla bean and that it's brewed as an imperial stout doesn't mix well.
No endorsement deal from them then?
No.
Okay.
Nope, I think my check's gonna bounce.
You got a check? Wow. So we are, we usually record in the same room, but unusually tonight we are all three in completely different locations, and so this edition of the podcast is brought to you by and over Skype.
Yep.
It is, although a horrifying time politically, a really exciting time in other ways. We are recording the day after SpaceX successfully launched and returned technically, I think they only returned the first stage. But nevertheless, the video of it is just, is like something out of like a 50s B-movie. It's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And so that's really interesting. And in a couple of days, NASA has announced they have a press conference to discuss something that they've discovered about exoplanets. No word yet on whether it's Tabby's star.
Yeah, I think that's kind of shooting it. I think if it was anything actually big, then like... We'd already know about it.
Judging by the way that the current administration leaks, I would imagine so.
Yeah. So you don't take the whole deep state thing too seriously?
I do, but it's tough for me to get past the joy of seeing Trump taken down a peg. There probably is more concerning in this than I'm allowing. I think the Trump defenders do have a point on this one. It is worrying that the spooks have taken down a political appointee.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's everything's worrying about this entire thing. You know, it's worrying that the spooks have taken down Michael Flynn. But the fact that Michael Flynn was taken down on something that seems to be so flimsy... you know, Michael Flynn was fired for doing his job and then lying about the fact that he was doing his job. There's got to be something deeper there.
So you don't think, Mike, that this is just a matter of Donald Trump really enjoying firing people?
Well, if that was the case, wouldn't he have done it during, like, a live press conference? He brings in his entire cabinet and then...
Omarosa.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I was not much of a fan of Flynn in the first place. And so, you know, to me, seeing him removed is not exactly disheartening. But the other part to it that I find worrying or troubling is what it revealed about the Trump White House in terms of the way that it processes new information. Because what we are told is that the Justice Department warned them of this for, you know, a couple of weeks, or at least a week. But only when it came to light did the White House act. It's, you know, the thing that he really seems to have been fired for was getting caught, rather than you know, whatever it was that he did.
Yeah.
As I understand it, he met with or called a Russian official and let them know that the sanctions that the Obama administration had imposed would not be long for this world once Trump came into office. Which is kind of a weird twilight, because, I mean, he is a private citizen, but on the other hand, he is also the incoming National Security Advisor designee.
Yeah, from what I see, like, there's... He did not violate... He may have violated the letter of the law, but he did not violate the spirit of the law, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I never like spirit of the law arguments, but I mean, the Logan Act is just never enforced, so...
Yeah, it has never been enforced. It's, you know, that's... To me, that's not the issue so much as the fact that apparently what he said was a big enough deal to cause him to step down.
But, you know, but that's, that's why I'm driving it, though. Is it? Did he step down because he did something wrong or because he was making Trump look bad?
Yeah, both, you know. I think that's the million-dollar question. Is this just Trump saying, you've made me look bad, now leave? Or is Trump saying, the fire is spreading, let's cut off this and hope that everyone doesn't notice the deeper wound? Because, I mean, going back to the spook leakage, the question that I have is, are these people leaking it just for partisan purposes? I mean, from what I understand, Flynn wasn't a popular guy. He made a lot of enemies whenever he was with the DIA. But is it something deeper? Is it that there's people in the intelligence communities who are looking at this and saying, you know, there's something here that's compromising national security, and we can't go through the normal channels because the normal channels is the president. And if the president is compromised or has people around him who's compromised, then maybe they don't trust those normal channels.
Yeah, I think it's probably as much about Trump as it is about Flynn. The people who use the deep state criticism, I feel like I should use the voice of God to do that one. The deep state.
The deep
state. In a world with a deep state.
Yeah. I feel like I'm in like a late 90s hacker movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're all on the run from the deep state.
Yes.
They start killing everyone around you.
But yeah, the people who advance that line will, you know, cheerfully tell anyone who will listen that what's really going on here is that the establishment / deep state, is a new name for the establishment as far as I can tell, really, really hates Donald Trump and is genuinely fearful. They probably wouldn't concede genuinely, but they are fearful of Trump, and they don't like him, and they're opposed to him, and they don't want to make America great again, because obviously if you're opposed to Trump, you don't want to make America great again. In much the same way as if you don't wear Nike, you're against just doing it.
Right. Yeah. That's why I wear Nike every day.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, I'm sure that the hackers themselves fancy themselves Edward Snowden, right? I'm sure that they feel like they are acting out of patriotic duty to the people and to their higher calling, whether it's specifically about Trump, or specifically about Flynn, or if it's about Trump more broadly. Because that's not the only leak that's been coming out, of course. It's been leaking like a sieve.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that does speak to the bias within the bureaucratic state, you know?
Yeah, and
even if... across everything.
It's not unreasonable to think that if a candidate gets elected saying they're going to drain the swamp, that the swamp is going to resist.
Yeah.
You know, that seems pretty reasonable. But, I mean, Trump just it seems to stir up kind of almost... I say this as someone who detests him and everything about him, but he seems to stir up just a delusional level of paranoia. I saw a tweet from a friend earlier that was talking about how dreadful and homophobic Trump is. It's like we've talked about this before. It's like, I can't think of anything in particular that Trump has done that's homophobic, and to the contrary, he strikes me as being much more gay-friendly than just about anyone else who could have won the Republican nomination.
Yeah, exactly.
Out of curiosity, does everybody remember that time when President Obama was campaigning and he took a giant LGBT flag and waved it around proudly? Everybody remember that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he totally didn't change it. He didn't evolve in his views in office.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But that's in the nature of the game, isn't it? You know, that your position is two steps to the left of wherever we currently are.
Yeah.
Speaking of gays and Republicans, Mike, do you want to talk about Milo?
You know, I would prefer not, but he's an interesting.
Is he?
The more I hear about him, the more he's interesting in that he's doing his best to loudly say, look at me, look at me, look at me. Look how different I am from everything and everybody. And, oh, isn't I edgy?
Yeah, and the protesters that then come out and say, look at him, look at him, look at him, isn't he edgy? And think that they're not helping
him. Yeah. No. They protesters, leftist protesters, like, are going to make sure that Trump wins a second term. Milo... Interesting things happening with Milo is that he was just invited and then disinvited from CPAC. But for those who aren't aware of who Milo is, he's an editor over at Breitbart. He is a flamboyantly gay rightist, I guess you could say, who has a lot of interaction with the alt-right and loves to promote, like, kind of stoked this anti-Semitic usage of words and provocations and all that stuff. And, of course, he had the protest at Berkeley where they all, you know, the leftists decide to embrace peace by rioting.
Berkeley, rioting about free speech.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, talk amongst yourself for a while. I've got to kick an insect out. Hang on.
Okay, have fun with that. Yep. What are your thoughts on Milo, Sam?
My thoughts on Milo is that, first of all, he is intentionally provocative. As far as I can tell, what he's doing is just trolling in real life. know, it's the sort of internet-style trolling taken to a real stage. And that's not to say that he's being insincere in some of his more controversial views. I think he is being sincere in his more controversial views. But at the same time, you can tell that he's getting a lot of energy. And it feels a very great sense of reward out of the people who are most easily triggered by his speech being triggered by his speech. Mm-hmm. I mean, he seeks that. He wants that. He absolutely loves it to be able to get leftists to act in the very stereotypical and childish way that he wants them to act, because it really feeds the narrative that he wants to purport for the left. And unfortunately, in a unfortunately very unsurprising bout of lack of self-awareness, many on the left have completely fallen for that. And it's disappointing to me, because I would really like to see someone effectively challenge Milo. You know, I would want someone to stand up to Milo and challenge him in a way that actually pulls the rug out from underneath him. But all that I seem to see is people challenging him in a way that just confirms the narrative that he's putting forth about them.
What about, it's interesting to see the larger right and the conservative movement embrace this man. Older men who are rather conservative are reposting his stuff on Facebook. People I've never thought before would repost something from a flamboyantly gay man or reposting his stuff, which is rather interesting.
Right. I think that comes back to the thing we've talked about before, that it's no longer about an idea, it's now about tribalism. He is of our tribe, and he throws flaming arrows, no pun intended, at the other side, and therefore is one of us. One of us. One of us.
Yeah.
I'm back, by the way. Sorry, we get invaded by stink bugs every winter. And they are not a problem. They just have to be kicked out when they get found. Otherwise, they will be eaten by the cats.
And we can't have that.
It's an act of mercy. You know, I like to practice the corporal works of mercy wherever I can. You know,
in the true Franciscan spirit.
That's right. That's right.
Anyway,
Brother Stinkbug.
Yeah, Brother Stinkbug. Yeah. But, you know, Milo does seem like an interesting figure in that, like, whenever I think of avant-garde, like, he's very much that. He's trying to put himself out there and being totally unique and special and all that good stuff. In a lot of ways, he kind of reminds me of Oscar Wilde. I don't know if that's stretching it a whole bunch. I don't think he's necessarily the same literary great that Oscar Wilde would be. But I think he's got definitely a similar bite to him, which is very interesting.
What bugs me about that style of kind of, I don't want to say confrontational, because, you know, Justice Scalia was a confrontational kind of guy. It was a different kind of thing. But what bothers me about Milo's shtick and the shtick of the people who kind of are in that orbit is that it strikes me as being the opposite or the counterpart to, remember the clown mask on, clown mask off, that was a criticism of Jon Stewart and the Daily Show people, that they would that they would say, you know, we're doing a hard-hitting journalism piece until someone calls them on it, and then it's just, oh, I'm just a comedian, you know, it's not my fault that people are getting their news from us. And the same thing with Milo, you know, they'll say horrible and outrageous things until someone calls them to on it, and then it's like, oh, well, we're just trolling. As if this is an excuse, right? And so they take the advantages and the benefits and then try to free ride on them.
Yeah. It seems to me like it's the death of seriousness. Nothing can be serious anymore. And it's rather interesting that, you know, all of this is very much kind of, this whole thing was born out on the left, or definitely not born on conservative or right-leaning circles, but, you know, now more and more people on the right have adopted it. This idea that seriousness doesn't matter, that it's about winning, rather than it's about being right or factual or anything like that. It's just
tribalism,
a game.
Well, it's just viciously rude. I find it very crass and, as my mother would say, common. You know, it really is just vulgar and has no appeal to me whatsoever. I mean, I have taken the view that he should just be ignored and not shared, even when he does make a valid point. Because otherwise, it's the same thing as Pope Francis. You know, it's like once you validate that he is a reasonable person to take advice from because he said something that you agree with, well, you can't then turn around and say, wow, well, but this other thing that he said, I don't want, you know, you shouldn't pay attention to that, because then it's just kind of, you know, making them a sock, you know, a kind of unintentional sock puppet for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do we want to move from unintelligence to artificial intelligence? Or do we want to do more Milo?
No, I think we're done with Milo. At least
thank God for that. Yeah. AI. Each of you had an AI thing you wanted to talk about, and it seems part of our usual routine.
So the thing I found that's very interesting is that apparently Google has been playing with aggressive AI, or at least teaching AI to be aggressive. They've taken... there's this game, a fruit-picking game, that they've been having the AI play against itself. And that the AI, as it gets closer to the end of the game, this AI gets more and more aggressive, taking time to, sabotage the opponent, rather than gathering its own fruit, which is showing more human-like behavior. Though it is interesting that also the AI is engaging in a game called Wolfpack, where it's a hunting game where it learns cooperation. And, you know, it is no surprise. To me, it's not a surprise that if you take a game that's designed to be competitive, the AI is going to say, okay, these are the parameters in which I am operating, and so therefore I need to be competitive and aggressive. Whereas if you take a game that where the AI is supposed to be cooperative, that the AI is in fact cooperative in the game. That makes sense. What's rather more interesting is that, if the AI remembers this and applies it to different things, especially that whole competitive and aggressiveness,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's can be a bit of a danger.
Yeah, this is literally the immediate backstory to the end of civilization in at least one novel.
I actually just watched a movie called Arrival.
Oh, okay.
Which is aliens come to Earth. And they're in this giant ships, and we're trying to figure out how to communicate with them.
I saw that with Bill Pullman as the president. No, I'm kidding.
And in it, the Chinese in the movie communicate with the aliens by teaching, because the aliens don't use words like we do. So they're trying to communicate with the aliens by teaching the aliens to play Go. And the scientists in America were concerned about that because they're starting off from competition as their main way of communicating. And I found it a rather interesting similarity to this.
It's very much an Obama-era picture, isn't it? It's like, the problem is that we're being competitive rather than cooperative.
There is a bit of that, yes. There is undertone, though actually it is a very good movie and I do recommend it. There's some interesting surprises. But yeah, I thought it was... I found a parallel to this where, you know, if we teach AI to be competitive, then surprise, they're going to be competitive.
My question is, do the parameters of the game reward it more for succeeding to a greater extent? Or is it... The part that I find interesting is the sabotage part. That it's not that it doesn't stop with just winning. It seems to want to win by greater margins or to injure its opponent. That, to me, is kind of notable, because there's only any... You can perfectly understand the utility maximization of sabotaging an enemy when you get some kind of immediate benefit out of it within the parameters of the mission, because then you, that's what you'd expect AI to do. Where it's interesting is in the is if there was no particular gain to that behavior.
Well, from reading it, I don't know. Like, it seems to me in the first game there isn't a cooperative element to the game. There's just a competitive element to the game, and they give them these tools to utilize, laser beams to knock stuff out of each other's hands. So it would make sense that the AI would utilize the tools it was given.
Yeah, but what I'm driving at is to what end? I mean, so what is the purpose that the behavior is solving? Is the behavior calculated to produce a particular benefit, or is it just arising because the AI is becoming more and more competitive and developing something, you know, approaching feelings about its opponent? You know, if it's a rational response to the parameters, then it makes some sense. If it's the idea that it wants to really pound its opponent into the dirt, that becomes slightly that becomes Skynet stuff. You know, do you want Cylons? Because that's how you get Cylons, literally.
Okay, so yeah, I don't know if I have a direct answer to this, but this is an interesting quote. Whenever there are enough apples in the environments, the agents learn to coexist peacefully and collect as many apples as they can. But whenever they reduce the number of apples, the agents figure that it might be to zap other agents to give themselves time to collect their own scarce apples. Okay. It seems like they can they're trying multiple scenarios.
Sure.
But it's the scarcity of resources that are driving the agents to act as they do.
Yeah, in which case it's behaving perfectly logically, and you would expect that if you don't give the machine a moral framework.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
If a machine has no conception of morality, then it is going to pursue, it's going to do what a computer would do. It's going to pursue the goal that you have given it with the tools that you have given it. I feel that this may be a segue to what Sam wanted to talk about.
Well, I actually have a question about that. Is that not an example of moral decision making? I mean, in what way would we draw a distinction between, say, a moral decision to do what benefits one in the short term, and in the long term, and a moral decision to do something that does not benefit one in the short term or the long term?
I would say this isn't a moral decision, only in as much as I don't have evidence that this computer is capable of making a moral decision. If it was a person making the same decisions, then I would readily accept that, yeah, they were making a moral decision to sabotage their adversaries in order to have enough food. But, like, this just seems to be a computer operating within the framework of a game. And so I'm not sure I could classify that as being a moral decision, just because it's operating within a set parameters. If anything, if you'd call it a moral decision, then it was a moral decision that was basically set up whenever the engineers made the game and made the parameters to operate within.
So I think this actually gets to some really interesting ground here. There's an argument to be made, certainly, that the actions are imbued with a moral dimension by the people who created the artificial intelligence, rather than the artificial intelligence itself. So out of curiosity, and this is very much leading into our other AI topic, how is that different from, say, God creating humans? Does the moral responsibility then ultimately lie with God for human acts? Or is there some other factor that confounds that?
Well, I would say the factor that's compounding is the extreme unpredictability of human actions. If you had one AI just choosing not to collect any apples just because, or another AI, even though there's plenty of apples on the field, this other AI just decides to go off and, like, take all the apples and conquer all the other AIs, then that would be the case where the moral decisions were on the AI. But because these AIs are operating just by the parameters set up, it seems to me that the moral decisions lie on the creators in those cases. If we operated by expectations at all times, then I could say that the moral decisions lie on it lies ultimately with God. But because we don't operate expectantly, then it doesn't seem to be me to be this case.
I say, wouldn't you need to have automata with the capacity to go outside of or beyond the parameters of their program in order to impute moral value? Now, obviously there is a moral dimension to it, to just actions, regardless of culpability, right? I mean, if you put Skynet in charge of the nukes, it doesn't really matter where ultimate moral responsibility lies if it uses them. The fact is still that, you know, 7 billion human beings are dead, and there's a moral valence to that. But if the program, I mean, the you could almost define immorality, if you like, or sin, or however you want to frame it, as going beyond the operator's manual in ways that are contrary to the user's manual. Using it for off-label purposes. And so if you don't have that capacity to go beyond the program in the first place, which doesn't seem like this AI has, then that seems different.
Okay, so that's actually a really good insight. We recently talked about the case study that MIT had in their magazine about AI that was learning and rewriting its own software. So once it gets to that point where it can kind of step outside the bounds of its own existing programming in order to adapt to a new situation, is that the point at which it would have a moral responsibility?
Not necessarily, because you could still make the argument that it's operating within the parameters of the program. If you design a program that is designed to write code that will build a better mousetrap, and it designs a better mousetrap, then it may have done something it may have done something on its own independently of you, but it's still doing what you have programmed it to do. So you need, I'm not quite sure what more you need, but you do need more than that. You to have culpability, it seems to me you need agency.
I'd have to say, at the point at which, if it understands what it's rewriting, the consequences of what it's rewriting, and why it was written that way in the first place, then it could have a moral dilemma, a moral aspect to it.
There are a lot of people, a lot of human people, who don't understand the reason for which God's law was written, and so are you proving too much there?
Well, I mean, you don't understand. People understand that killing is wrong.
Sure.
I'm not looking for perfect understanding. and we don't understand everything behind the moral law, but there is an intuitive part to especially natural law. And so, like, you know, if you have an AI that has two directives and they seem to be in conflict to it, at least according to the AI, you know, the AI is supposed to keep the streets safe, but at the same time, it can't kill anybody. And this AI has this ability to, you know, rewrite itself, and it finds this not killing anybody part really interfering with that keeping the streets safe. And so even though it knows that it's not supposed to kill anyone, it chose to rewrite that part of its programming it to allow it to kill people in order to make the streets safe, then that's a moral choice.
Right. I would agree with that, though I would point out that we are now literally talking about 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
But that, this is exactly what drove the AI in that movie mad.
Yeah.
I was just going to mention that there is actually a case in the past few years that I was reading about of an artificial intelligence that was exhibiting the signs of paranoid schizophrenia. So,
yeah,
you know, welcome to the future, gentlemen.
Yes.
So let's kind of jump off here and talk about, since we're already starting on it, the theological dimension of artificial intelligence. You know, what does that mean for us as Christians? There was an article in The Atlantic titled, "Is AI a Threat to Christianity?" And I'll have to give credit here to Jonathan Merritt for writing that one. And the article is about what sort of consequences there might be for religion if artificial intelligence really becomes a very, very big thing.
Well, can we back up slightly and take a pass on what constitutes artificial intelligence? If we can come back to Dollhouse for a moment. Remember in that show, you have actual human beings who have their memories and personalities wiped, and then a new assembled personality put into them. Does that constitute artificial intelligence? If you are building a personality out of the bricks of other personalities, but you produce something that the gestalt is new, that is a distinct person that didn't previously exist, that would seem to be artificial intelligence, wouldn't it? And so would the same concern apply in the Dollhouse scenario to the Skynet scenario? And if not, why not? I think that's a useful question because it separates out whether we're... I think that kind of gets past the technophobia aspect of it. Right? It's not so very different because with that technology you could, and various places in the show did, put a complete other personality that was an actual person into another person. But the usual use case of the technology was to assemble a temporary personality. And it would seem to me that's AI in the same way as if we write code that says, you know, create a personality, isn't it?
Yeah,
I don't dispute you on that point.
Oh, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I don't dispute you on that point. I mean, my question was really getting at the theological implications, and you know, I'm not fussed either way about the example.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a more, you know, obviously a deeper AI, a more robust AI, poses greater questions. AI that is actually acting in a true autonomous fashion and is able to go out of its initial programming and do so successfully. Poses questions. But, you know, as if it's a... Is it a threat? I don't think so.
What if the AI comes to believe in God?
Well, that is good.
If the AI looks at the evidence, I mean, as many naturally intelligent people do, or biologically intelligent, maybe I should say, looks at the evidence and concludes that that the existence of God is the most reasonable interpretation of the data. Is that not a danger to atheists?
Yeah, I can't wait to see that AI take on, like, Bill Nye.
It'll be Bill Nye's head in a glass case like Futurama. Like a Bender bot or something. Yeah.
You know, the AI converts to fundamentalist church and becomes a young earth creationist.
I don't recommend baptism by water. Sam, can I ask for clarification on the question? Are you asking, did it pose challenges for us in terms of how we treat the AI or in terms of whether we are correct in our worldview?
Both.
Okay. The how we treat them thing, there's an obvious practical imperative, but I would be interested to hear comments on what our moral obligations would be to the safe well-being of the AI. Aside from, you know, assume that it's an AI that's not likely to rise up and kill us, and so it's not an actual physical threat, whether we would have obligations to that, I think that's part of what you're driving at, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think that's actually probably the easier question, is that at least those people who created the AI would have the same sort of obligations to it that they would to people who create a child. That, mm-hmm. in terms of its well-being, that's the sort of obligation you would have. You know, the more interesting question is, of course, you know, for a sacramental religion, what do you do with some of the issues there? Like you mentioned baptism. If you have a sacramental religion, does the AI participate in that? Questions like, does the AI have a soul? And is there grounds for thinking that the AI has a soul? Those are the more interesting questions to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's part of, I suppose, why the example matters. Because if you're dealing with a doll or an... with a doll or an organic Cylon, then they could participate in the sacramental aspects. Whereas if you're talking about a Centurion or Skynet, you know, something disembodied or something with a mechanical body, then they couldn't, regardless of the answer to the soul question.
Well, I mean, if an AI comes to believe in God, then that's great, and that's natural. All of creation glorifies God, and an artificial intelligence is part of God's creation as much as anything that we create because of, you know, ultimately His inspiration.
But what if it's your Apple Watch, and your Apple Watch is busy finding Jesus instead of setting your meetings? Because inevitably, if AI is created, it will be integrated into yet more mundane tasks, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That just seems to be in the glide path. And so, when your toaster starts talking back to you, do you treat it like a companion to explore the mysteries of the universe, or is it a bug in the software?
I think, you know, my response would be to talk to the toaster about work and prayer, and maybe making its prayer its work prayer. And,
its
you know,
vocation, yes.
Yeah, your vocation, toaster, is to make me awesome toast. And so, you know, glorify
not
God.
Shall thee make it.
Glorify right. God by giving me just the right crispiness on the toast. you know, and quite frankly, if it's an AI and it's as powerful as it is, it can spend 90% of its energy, considering God, and then 10% of the time, if not less, doing everything else we need it to do.
Can I just point out, everything we've just said in the last couple of minutes, at some future date, will be branded hate speech by a liberal.
Yes, yes.
Equal rights for the differently sentient.
Yeah, you know, and it is a question of, like, if your watch asks you, when I die, where am I going to go? You know, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Siri, can you add a calendar appointment? Yeah. I'd rather talk to you about Jesus Christ. Have you found your Lord and Savior? If you died right now...
Yeah, you know, that's a... If you have the AI contemplating, especially unprodded, because, I mean, like, you could prod an AI to try and ask questions about its immortality, but... Mm-hmm. If an AI unprompted questions that, mm-hmm. you know, that's a significant event, and maybe at that point it has something, but that's beyond our, you know, that's beyond our competence.
Yeah, I mean, a soul is more than a set of memories and the ability to calculate, mm-hmm. and the ability to reason. But where that flashpoint is, where it becomes something that's independent, is, you know, probably more in the realm of philosophy than I'm qualified to speak to.
I
have a feeling that it's one of those things that you'll know it when you see it.
Yeah.
But there will be boundary cases, like the toaster, right? You know, when your car has artificial intelligence in it, right? So maybe we should talk about Kit. Right? So yes. Kit is a bespoke artificial intelligence that has a very specific function but seems to be able to have a wide-ranging, parasentience. Mm-hmm. Jarvis becomes that over the course of the Marvel movies, or seems to, at least. You know, you can imagine boundary cases where it's like, I don't know at what point this is just a natural language interface, and mm-hmm. at what point it's a genuine AI.
Mm-hmm.
So, out of curiosity, going back to the question of whether an artificial intelligence would have a soul, is there reason to think that Kit would have a soul?
No.
Well, it certainly acts like it does, right?
How so?
Because it has a personality. It has a distinctive personality. I suppose this is also true of Jarvis. But Hal doesn't really have a personality per se.
Yeah, but I could fake a personality. Like,
if it sabotages your opponent searching for the apples.
You could successfully code something. In fact, you know, I think that's more likely, is that what we're going to do to make people more comfortable with interacting with these things is we're going to make them a little bit wacky. We're going to have them say, you know, sometimes they'll decide to be cranky, and there'll be a random mm-hmm. algorithm determining whether or not they're cranky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's different than having a soul.
Is auto-generation part of it, the ability to be a self-created creation?
I think that's part of it, and I think also the ability to contemplate your own immortality. You know, if Kit ever said, you know, what's going to happen to me if I, you know, I can't go on these adventures with you anymore because I might get hit by a Mack truck, and then what will happen to me? Then I'd be able to consider, well, maybe this guy has a soul, because it's got fear of its own mortality.
There's a nice upstate car farm where you'll go.
Exactly. Yeah.
But there are people who don't seem to fear their own death, so can that be the criterion?
Yeah, I guess.
Although,
I mean,
usually when people don't fear their own death, it tends to be for religious reasons, but not exclusively.
Yeah, or major repression.
Yeah. There are plenty of people who at least will tell you in the abstract when they're young and healthy that they fear pain, but they don't fear being dead. So in mm-hmm. that sense, they fear death in the sense of the transition rather than the state of not being anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Would that falsify anything? Or?
I don't know. I wouldn't think so. I think, you know, pain, death, there's something about the human experience to at least we all think about, if not spend tons of times on, we all think about, you know, not being here, what's going to happen, that sort of thing. That question comes up in people's minds and comes up again and again.
Usually after one too many chocolate martinis.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's part of, you know, having a soul is considering what's going to happen to it afterwards.
So, Mike, I have a counterexample I'd like to just see what you think about.
Yeah.
You think that children in the womb have a soul, right?
Yes.
And so do you think that children in the womb are considering their own mortality?
No, they don't have the capacity for it yet. I guess it's a potential thing. I don't know.
Well, what does it mean to have the potential to contemplate your own existence? Doesn't the computer have the horsepower to do that should it choose to do so? Isn't that? I think that's Sam's point.
That wasn't my point, but I thought it would lead to an interesting discussion.
Yeah, that isn't. I mean, that's the thing, right? It has all of this potential, but does it actually? Does it ever reach this point? I mean, with human beings, it's getting to the point of contemplating your own immortality is a development issue. And, you know, of course you have kids, you know, people who for various reasons don't reach that, but it's something that defines humanity as a group.
So let's talk about Thomas Aquinas then, Mike. You brought him up previously this evening.
Oh boy, yes.
So one of the things that Thomas Aquinas thought, and as you both know, I'm not a huge fan of Thomas Aquinas, but I can appreciate his very systematic thought. One of the things that he thought was that what makes us distinct as human beings is our rational faculties. You know, he thought that lots and lots of things have a soul. It's not the question of whether or not you have a soul, but what makes you a human person is the rational faculties. At least as a class. As you said, there are some exceptions to that, but as a class, we have rational faculties, or at least the potential for rational faculties. So, you know, is the question that we're getting at here in a Thomistic frame the question of whether or not AI have equivalent rational faculties? Is that really what we're asking?
Well, for me, it's a question of how do they use it? Because they'll get to the point, if AI doesn't already have equivalent rational faculties, it'll get to the point where it will have and greatly exceed all of our rational faculties, our ability to reason and analyze and think and all of that. It's the question of how do you use it?
Maybe reason could be distinguished from calculation. If you think of a lot of Supreme Court cases and ad law cases in particular, where the right answer, quote unquote, is dependent on, you know, very complicated interplays of very small minutiae of wording in two different federal regulations, judges can reason it out, and they may not necessarily always acknowledge exactly what it is that they're doing, but they will come to an answer that is a reasoned decision, even though the other option in the case is also a reasonable possibility, but they will say this is the correct answer. I'm not sure that a that a computer would necessarily be able to do that, because it would probably spit the bet on what it means to be reasonable. Or right.
Is there a reason that we would suspect that?
Okay, so there was a case a few years ago in which the there's a federal statute that I think the framing was that there was a sentence enhancement dependent on what happened with the quote-unquote proceeds of a gambling enterprise. Mm. And the question in the case was, does the statute mean the net proceeds or the gross proceeds? And so what's the right answer? And to get to the right answer on that, you know, you go to a large array of background rules. I mean, you could program Justice Scalia's book into a computer, but then which rule ultimately controls? Well, in that particular case, the rule that controlled was a rule of construction called the rule of lenity, which is if the statute is ambiguous, the tie goes to the defendant. Because we intuit that it is reasonable that the government should have the heavier burden to carry when depriving a person of life, liberty, or property. But unless that is explicitly programmed into a machine, then is it going to be able to reason out to the same decision?
Well, that depends. Are we talking about a neural net that has access to a lot of legal data? Because if so, then the answer to that is probably yes.
Well, but this is the thing, though. It's how ambiguous does it have to be before you go to the default rule, right? Suppose your AI looked at that and said, "Well, I've run a statistical analysis of the use every time Congress used the word proceeds in that particular session of Congress and in that particular Congress." And throughout all time, and as a result of my analysis of those statistics, I conclude that the correct answer is net proceeds. And so it never gets to the rule of lenity in the first place, because its judgment as to what constitutes ambiguous is off. As people, I think we have a pretty good feel for what is ambiguous and what isn't. But to a very smart AI, it may say, hey, you know, there's nothing ambiguous about this whatsoever based on this fantastically complicated statistical analysis that no human could ever perform. Or, you know, it goes out and absorbs the authorized biography of every member of Congress that voted on it and psychoanalyzes what their most likely disposition was as to that particular question. Too clever by half.
Mm-hmm. So out of curiosity, how significantly do you think that differs from our current justices who are frequently too clever by half?
I don't think that Justice Breyer's problem is that he's too clever by half. I suppose that if nothing else, The current ones are at least human, and so they tend, as a rule, to err on the side of being humane. Even Justice Scalia, who has a reputation as being kind of a fire-breathing law and order kind of guy, he wrote the opinion in the case that I'm referring to, and was a big supporter of the rule of lenity, because he understood that government is a dangerous thing. But does a computer understand that government is a dangerous thing? To a computer, government may just look like discipline. Who couldn't want more discipline?
Well, to an artificial intelligence, government could also well look like an impediment that it doesn't need. And so, it may have a heuristic in it that it has developed to undermine that impediment wherever it can. There's certainly nothing impossible about that.
Yeah, and I think that is the point at which it's making its own choices, and so those choices are moral choices or not.
Mm-hmm. So out of curiosity, what do you all think about the idea that it is our very irrationality that makes us distinctive in our free choices?
Or at least the not being bound by reason. that we can act against our own interests, I take it you mean.
Yeah, well, we can act against our own interests, and we can act in ways that make very little sense, as Mike has pointed out with some earlier examples. And so, yes, I mean, is that part of what tells us that we have some sort of agency?
Yeah, the ability to make bad choices is what allows us to make good choices.
Yeah. I think the ability to look at, you know, to go beyond what makes immediate sense or any sort of sense for us, you know, the ability to, you know, sacrifice to save someone who isn't related to us.
Yeah. Or the capacity to have strong opinions about things to which there is no rational answer.
Yeah.
Right, you know, I would be interested to know if we had a super powerful AI, I would like to ask it which team it fancies in the Super Bowl. Right? Because there's no logical reason for the computer to have any preference one way or the other. And I think the point at which the computer has an opinion on that, on something as trivial as sports ball, sorry, Mike, is the point at which you can say now we have truly created a mind rather than simply a very clever calculator.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we have to have the capacity to be wrong by supporting the Patriots. So.
Well, you know, the AI had a good relationship with Bill Belichick, you know.
Does the AI have terrible hair?
Yeah.
I think it could.
What should I say? I'm trying to frame the thought coherently. Thank goodness for editing. I can come back in later and make this sound like I knew what I was talking about.
There you go.